It's Wednesday, March 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump scores victories in three states, while Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders defeats former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Michigan. A reporter describes conditions for refugees on the border between Greece and Macedonia.
And I think that this week, covering the refugees in northern Greece has been one of those events, one of those stories that has been, for me, a pretty profound experience.
And the legendary producer of the Beatles, Sir George Martin, dies at the age of 90. It's all ahead. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders scored a surprise victory in Tuesday's Democratic primary in Michigan, while Republican Donald Trump widened his lead with victories in Michigan, Mississippi, and Hawaii. For more on the results, I'm joined by VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, looking at the Republicans first, does this mean now that Donald Trump is likely to emerge as his party's nominee?
It's looking more likely after the latest results on Tuesday. Part of the reason is that there were a couple of national polls that had showed some weakening in his approval numbers, but the results in Mississippi and Michigan in particular seemed to push back on the idea that the Republican establishment, the anti-Trump forces, are making a lot of headway. With that being said, we're in a critical week now, leading up to March 15th. There are five big states voting on the 15th, including Ohio and Florida. And we have two candidates in the race. That's their home states. Marco Rubio for Florida, John Kasich for Ohio. To keep the anti-Trump momentum going, or to find new momentum, they're going to have to win probably their home states, at least one of them, to sort of hold Trump at bay for another week or two as he marches toward the nomination.
Well, one of Trump's rivals, another one of his rivals, Senator Ted Cruz, he won the Idaho primary. How far behind is he from Trump?
Well, the interesting thing about Cruz is he didn't really factor much in the Tuesday voting. He is, including just today, calling on the Republican rivals to get out of the race so he can take Cruz on one-on-one. But, you know, Cruz's strength was supposed to be in the South, especially with the Christian evangelical conservatives. It hasn't worked out that way. Trump has actually got the better of him there. And I think the party is still kind of trying to figure out who's their best alternative. There has been some outreach by the establishment to Ted Cruz, which is a great irony because early on he was also seen as kind of an enemy of the establishment. Some people are trying to make openings to him now, but I think it shows that even with the millions of dollars in anti-Trump TV ads they're running in places like Florida, the establishment now is really up against the wall, trying to take one last desperate attempt here to stop Trump.
Well, turning to the Democrats, what does the Sanders victory in Michigan mean for the Clinton camp?
I think it means that the race will be longer and a little more difficult than they had hoped. Hillary Clinton has long wanted to turn the focus to Trump and the Republican race to sort of bind the party together. But the results in Michigan show that, especially as we move into the industrial heartland of the United States, Sanders' message about bad trade deals, displacing American workers, is having some resonance. And Clinton was hoping to rely on African-American support primarily to kind of put Sanders away. It's not really happening. And now we've got these five big states coming up next Tuesday. And particularly in places like Ohio and maybe Illinois, Sanders may have some, you know, opportunities here to close the gap with Clinton. But the ace in the hole for Hillary Clinton is the superdelegates are on her side, several hundred of them, which gives her a pad. And the Democratic race is proportional all the way through June, which means Sanders would really have to start winning states by huge margins to accrue the number of delegate gains to kind of overtake Clinton. And that's not looking very likely.
Yeah, particularly as he goes against a campaign that's so well-funded and organized like her, you know, because she's run, of course, before, and her husband has run.
But he's well-funded as well. And he, I think the message from the Michigan primary is he's in it for a while, and that is going to prolong the Democratic race and may distract them from hoping to focus on the Republicans earlier than they'd like.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Jim. That's national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, also joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's the reaction on social media to all this political news?
Well, the big reaction is part of the big breaking news is that Carly Fiorina, the businesswoman, herself a presidential candidate until she dropped out a few months ago, has come out and in a surprise endorsed Ted Cruz for president. So this may be, as Jim was talking about, part of the establishment kind of coalescing around Ted Cruz. Now, in social media, there's a lot of anger about this, certainly much of it coming from Trump supporters saying, well, it's just one loser endorsing another, not going to do him any good. But then Ted Cruz supporters are thrilled with this endorsement. I think they're thrilled with just about any endorsement they can get, especially from a former candidate. And they're saying, well, the fact that everyone's saying all these negative things about Carly Fiorina means that she must have done something right. So they're thrilled about this. It'll remain to be seen how much of an impact this has, but at least at the moment, it's capturing attention on social media.
And what else is trending?
Well, as we talked about this morning, sad news that George Martin, known as the fifth Beatle, the producer of the Beatles, passed away at age 90. And as we looked at social media throughout the day and as the news has spread, we're getting more reaction. Paul McCartney reacting and saying that George Martin was like a second father to him. A lot of music stars reacting and saying that he was one of the best in the business, certainly one of the most influential music producers by helping to create the Beatles. Something interesting, though, I saw on social media is that a number of people were a bit confused. They thought that George R.R. Martin had died. Oh. George R.R. Martin, of course, being the creator of the popular Game of Thrones series. So there was a bit of confusion there on social media, but people quickly clearing that up, but creating a few laughs among this social media posters saying, nope, you didn't quite get that right. You were two letters off. And a whole person off as well.
Okay. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's Andrew Palshevsky, and we will have more reaction to the death of George Martin later in the show. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Researchers from three U.S. universities have found what they describe as an important biological connection between the Zika virus and the serious birth defect known as microcephaly. This birth defect can cause babies to be born with an unusually small head and inhibited brain development. The scientists who made their findings, based on experiments performed with lab-grown human stem cells, discovered that the Zika virus is attracted to and infects the cells that go on to form the brain's outer layer, known as the cerebral cortex. While they admit their findings do not provide absolute proof of a link between Zika and microcephaly, the researchers say that discovering vulnerability of the cortex-forming cells to the virus is significant. A connection between Zika and microcephaly arose from last year's spread of the virus throughout the Americas and a significant increase in the cases of microcephaly, especially in Brazil. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll look back at the life of producer George Martin. Thousands of migrants from Syria and other countries are now stranded in Greece, blocked from their goal of reaching northern Europe after Macedonia closed its border on Wednesday. Jamie Detmer has spent a week in the region, and he tells me how the migrants are faring and how their situation impacts him.
There are times as a journalist when events you're covering, stories you're covering, are particularly powerful for you, and you feel almost privileged to be covering, reporting on. And I think that this week, covering the refugees in northern Greece, has been one of those events, one of those stories that has been, for me, a pretty profound experience. I've been covering the Syrian war for 4 years, 4.5 years, almost since the beginning. So I know what a lot of these families have gone through back in Syria, particularly in northern Syria, but also other parts. And then to see them here after an epic journey for many of them. 55% of the refugees here in northern Greece at the moment are women and children. They have gone through tremendous difficulties to get here. They have witnessed extraordinary violence. They have taken great risks to try to make it to the European Union. And now they're stuck on the border because the Macedonians have closed the border and have the support of other Central European countries as well for the closing of that border and for the blocking of the refugees to go further into the European Union, into countries that they want to settle in, mainly because they've got family that they want to reunite with.
What will you take away with you?
Some of the things that I'll take away from covering Northern Greece the last week will be the children in particular. We've had many kids wanting to hold our hands as we've walked around taking notes and taking pictures. The kids are very open, very engaging. They often want their photographs taken. They're in some ways more resilient than the adults. I think emotionally they adapt more quickly.
What concerns you the most?
One of the very worrying signs of the distress that the refugees are going through in northern Greece is their physical condition. And again, this is affecting the children. A very, very bad respiratory infection that has spread like wildfire. Many of the children are wheezing and coughing. And there aren't enough doctors for the parents to be able to take the kids to. There's not enough medicine around. They get very damp. There are very big downpours regularly here, and they just aren't able to dry out sufficiently. And there's also a lack of food, and nutrition obviously isn't good either in the food that they can get from local traders or from the food that's being distributed by Doctors Without Borders, who are the driving force behind this makeshift camp. I think the story is also important, not just on an immediate human level, but on a broader one. I think it could well define what happens to the European Union, what the European Union becomes. And there is talk now, of course, that some of these people, maybe all of them, will be returned to Turkey, and the European Union will then decide which of these war refugees they will settle. And I think there'll be a very political, a very big political fight over the plans that are now being discussed.
Reporter Jamie Detmer on the border between Greece and Macedonia. Iran's recent elections and the lifting of international sanctions appear to be weakening decades of conservative domination of parliament and the council that chooses the country's supreme leader. These recent developments are also providing a fresh look at a country that has been somewhat isolated from the West. International Edition's Peter Heinlein spoke by phone with Vivian Walt, a reporter on assignment for Fortune magazine, who's visiting Tehran for the first time in 10 years. Walt discusses what Iranians expect and hope for at the dawn of a new era.
Well, I find Tehran somewhat changed since the last time I was here, but that was nearly 10 years ago. Certainly, there is a feeling after the elections that the country is maybe inevitably heading towards a big change. The reformists, those who do not want so strict a kind of theologically based society, if you like, did an absolute clean sweep of the elections in Tehran. It appeared as if the entire city wanted a big change and was solidly behind President Rouhani's reform program. Well, and I think that took people somewhat by surprise.
Well, what were people voting for when they voted for Rouhani, President Rouhani's allies?
Basically, what people want is to rejoin the world. I think, by and large, if you ask people at the heart of the issue, what do you want? Very few of them will say, we want better jobs or we want more money. They want to be a normal country. And I think particularly for the younger generation, which is the vast majority of this country, is younger than 35. So you have an entire nation, really, who's come of age after the revolution, which was 37 years ago. So it was a long time ago. And for these generations, they are increasingly finding ways to access the internet, to see what the rest of the world is up to on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter. Actually, all those sites are officially banned in Iran, but it appears that everybody has some ways of getting access to them. And they simply want to be part of that world. They don't want to be isolated. They don't want to be under embargo. It's not as if there are things in Iran which you cannot find. You can find almost anything. But it's a fact of being so isolated politically and of not being able to simply be a normal nation that I think has really gotten on under people's skin.
Vivian Walt, a reporter on assignment for Fortune magazine. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, a man who's been termed as the fifth Beatle, producer Sir George Martin, has died at the age of 90. I'm joined now by VOA Music's Ray McDonald, who's here to discuss Martin's life and career. Ray, how significant was George Martin to the Beatles?
Sarah, I don't think you can overstate his significance to the Beatles. What we had with George Martin and the Beatles was a rare case of chemistry, of great talents coming together. George Martin started out with the BBC's classical music division. He got hired by EMI in 1950, and he oversaw their Parlophone label, where he did a lot of classical music production. He also produced novelty records and comedy records. And while he was doing this, he got a very good feel for studio technology at the time, and he even helped advance it. He did some early electronic music experiments. And when he came upon the Beatles in 1962, they were a young, scuffling band out of Liverpool. They'd cut their teeth in nightclubs in Liverpool and Hamburg, Germany. You know, they were some pretty rough kids, but they had ambition and they had creativity. And he signed them to Parlophone Records largely because he liked their sense of humor. Because having produced comedy artists like Spike Milligan, you know, George appreciated a good sense of humor. And what he was able to do is to harness the Beatles' energy and creativity in such a way that they created art.
What were some of the instructions that he gave them, particularly in some of those early songs, like Please Please Me or, you know, Love Me Do?
Well, Please Please Me was a great example of George Martin's input because it had started out as a ballad. And George says, if we speed this song up, we're going to get a number one hit. And that's exactly what happened, and it became the Beatles' breakout single in England. So George knew what would work commercially. And he took the Beatles' raw ideas, and he shaped them, and he taught them how to play the studio like an instrument. He was the one who came up with the idea of putting a string quartet behind Yesterday. Originally, it was just Paul and a guitar. And he said, Paul, why don't we put a string quartet behind this? And Paul's reaction was, well, no, we're a rock band. We don't do that. And he said, let's just do it. If you don't like it, we don't have to use it. And of course, Yesterday became the most covered pop song of all time. In another example, Eleanor Rigby, he said he was inspired by Bernard Herrmann's soundtrack music for Hitchcock's Psycho. So he used those stabbing violins to connote an idea of aggression. And as the Beatles became more and more ambitious, he rose to the occasion, most notably in the Sgt. Pepper album, which, considering it was done on a four-track studio in 1966 and 67, just absolutely blew everybody away with its technology. It was tomorrow's music today back then. And so George Martin was the Beatles' not-so-secret weapon. He was the one who really helped them elevate themselves above the competition. Mm-hmm. And had everybody else playing catch-up.
And the Beatles became, over time, they kind of evolved into more of a studio band when they stopped touring so much.
Right, right. They stopped touring in 1966, and it was all studio work after that. And even after the Beatles broke up, Martin continued to work with them. He worked with Ringo Starr. He worked with Paul McCartney. He produced a couple of Paul's bigger solo hits, Ebony and Ivory and Say, 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 with Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson. And so he maintained close contact with the Beatles. And he also worked with other acts. He produced America and several other big-name acts. But he will always be associated with the Beatles.
Thanks very much, Ray. That's VOA Music's Ray McDonald.
Thanks, Sarah.
Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people.
The song Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Society of Professional Journalists, in its voluntary code of ethics, says that journalists should seek the truth and report it, minimize harm, act independently, and be accountable. Distorting and mischaracterizing statements of officials so as to produce an inflammatory article seemingly aimed at provoking violence is not in keeping with professional journalism. In a polemic entitled Chibitoke, An Image That Has Ended the Illusion of the Concept of Sindhu Mujua, or I Am Not a Slave, that was published by www.burundi-24.com on February 21st, the publication mischaracterizes statements and actions by U.S. officials, including the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Neither the tone of the article nor the significant misleading and inflammatory statements can be characterized as meeting the internationally generally recognized standards of free, independent, and professional media services. The United States Embassy in Burundi, in an open letter published on its website, strongly condemned the intent apparent in the article to provoke anti-Rwandan sentiments, possibly including violence. In this regard, the embassy noted that the president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, had himself condemned hate speech or violent language on February 20th in Chibitoke. The embassy further noted, moreover, that unlike the author or authors of the article, President Nkurunziza affirmed in Chibitoke that all Burundians, including those who have fled the country, must participate in inclusive political dialogue regarding the path to peace for Burundi. The assertion in the article that civil society triggered the insurgency suggests that www.burundi-24.com believes that all elements of civil society that do not share its view should be excluded from the dialogue, despite President Nkurunziza's call for inclusive dialogue. In its open letter, the U.S. Embassy emphasized that the U.S. Ambassador to Burundi, Her Excellency Don LeBerry, and the U.S. Special Envoy, Mr. Thomas Pariello, went to Chibitoke on February 20th to express the U.S. government's continued solidarity with all Burundians, regardless of political orientation, who seek the chance to educate and raise their children in a secure, pluralist Burundi. A free press is essential to building a free and stable civil society. Journalists play an invaluable role when they follow the canons of their profession and provide the public with reporting that is fair and accurate and commentary that is responsible.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.